The menu for the party was fairly simple. There would be a case of champagne and samosas from an Indian restaurant in Hartford, and big trays of rice with chicken and almonds and orange peels, which Sanjeev had spent the greater part of the morning and afternoon preparing. He had never entertained on such a large scale before, and worried that there would not be enough to drink. Ran out at one point to buy another case of champagne, just in case. For this reason, he burned one of the rice trays and had to start over again. Twinkle swept the floors and volunteered to pick up the samosas. She had an appointment for a manicure and a pedicure in that direction anyway. Sanjeev had planned to ask if she would consider clearing the menagerie off the mantel, if only for the party, but she left while he was in the shower. She was gone for a good 3 hours, and so it was Sanjeev who did the rest of the cleaning. By 5:30, the entire house sparkled with scented candles that Twinkle had picked up in Hartford, illuminating the items on the mantel, and slender stalks of burning incense planted into the soil of potted plants. Each time he passed the mantel, he winced, dreading the raised eyebrows of his guests as they viewed the flickering ceramic saints, the salt and pepper shakers designed to resemble Mary and Joseph. Still, they would be impressed, he hoped, by the lovely bay windows, the shining parquet floors, the impressive winding staircase, the wooden wainscoting, as they sipped champagne and dipped samosas in chutney. Douglas, one of the new consultants at the firm, and his girlfriend Nora were the first to arrive. Both were tall and blonde, wearing matching wire-rimmed glasses and long black overcoats. Nora wore a black hat full of sharp, thin feathers that corresponded to the sharp, thin angles of her face. Her left hand was joined with Douglas's. In her right hand was a bottle of cognac with a red ribbon wrapped around its neck, which she gave to Twinkle.
"Great lawn, Sanjeev," Douglas remarked. "We've got to get our rake out ourselves, sweetie. And this must be
my wife, Tanima.
Call me Twinkle."
"What an unusual name," Nora remarked. Twinkle shrugged.
"Not really. There's an actress in Bombay named Dimple Kapadia. She even has a sister named Simple."
Douglas and Nora raised their eyebrows simultaneously, nodding slowly, as if to let the absurdity of the names settle in.
"Pleased to meet you, Twinkle. Help yourself to champagne, there's gallons."
"I hope you don't mind my asking," Douglas said, "but I noticed the statue outside. Are you guys Christian? I thought you were Indian."
"There are Christians in India," Sanjeev replied, "but we're not."
"I love your outfit," Nora told Twinkle. "And I adore your hat. Would you like the grand tour?"
The bell rang again and again and again. Within minutes, it seemed, the house had filled with bodies and conversations and unfamiliar fragrances. The women wore heels and sheer stockings and short black dresses made of crepe and chiffon. They handed their wraps and coats to Sanjeev, who draped them carefully on hangers in the spacious coat closet, though Twinkle told people to throw their things on the ottomans in the solarium. Some of the Indian women wore their finest saris, made with gold filigree that draped in elegant pleats over their shoulders. The men wore jackets and ties and citrus-scented aftershaves. As people filtered from one room to the next, presents piled onto the long cherry-wood table that ran from one end of the downstairs hall to the other. It bewildered Sanjeev that it was for him and his house and his wife that they had all gone to so much care. The only other time in his life that something similar had happened was his wedding day. But somehow this was different, for these were not his family, but people who knew him only casually and, in a sense, owed him nothing. Everyone congratulated him. Lester, another co-worker, predicted that Sanjeev would be promoted to vice president in 2 months maximum. People devoured the samosas and dutifully admired the freshly painted ceilings and walls, the hanging plants, the bay windows, the silk paintings from Jaipur. But most of all, they admired Twinkle and her brocaded salwar kameez, which was the shade of a persimmon with a low scoop in the back and a little string of white rose petals she had coiled cleverly around her head, and the pearl choker with a sapphire at its center that adorned her throat. Over hectic jazz records played under Twinkle's supervision, they laughed at her anecdotes and observations,
forming a widening circle around her, while Sanjeev replenished the samosas that he kept warming evenly in the oven and getting ice for people's drinks, and opening more bottles of champagne with some difficulty, and explaining for the 40th time that he wasn't Christian. It was Twinkle who led them in separate groups up and down the winding stairs to gaze at the back lawn, to peer down the cellar steps. "Your friends adore the poster in my study," she mentioned to him triumphantly, placing her hand on the small of his back as they, at one point, brushed past each other. Sanjeev went to the kitchen, which was empty, and ate a piece of chicken out of the tray on the counter with his fingers because he thought no one was looking. He ate a second piece, then washed it down with a gulp of gin straight from the bottle.
Great house, great rice.
Sunil, an anesthesiologist, walked in, spooning food from his paper plate into his mouth.
Do you have more champagne?
Your wife's wow,
added Prabal, following behind. He was an unmarried professor of physics at Yale. For a moment, Sanjeev stared at him blankly, then blushed. Once at a dinner party, Prabal had announced that Sophia Loren was wow, as was Audrey Hepburn.
Does she have a sister?
Sunil picked a raisin out of the rice tray.
Is her last name Little Star?
The two men laughed and started eating more rice from the tray, plowing through it with their plastic spoons. Sanjeev went down to the cellar for more liquor. For a few minutes, he paused on the steps, in the damp, cool silence, hugging the second crate of champagne to his chest as the party drifted above the rafters. Then he set the reinforcements on the dining table.
Yes, everything. We found them all in the house, in the most unusual places, he heard Twinkle saying in the living room. In fact, we keep finding them.
No.
Yes, every day is like a treasure hunt. It's too good.
God only knows what else we'll find. No pun intended.
That was what started it. As if by some unspoken pact, the whole party joined forces and began combing through each of the rooms, opening closets on their own, peering under chairs and cushions, feeling behind curtains, removing books from bookcases. Groups scampered, giggling and swaying, up and down the winding staircase.
We've never explored the attic, Twinkle announced suddenly, and so everybody followed.
How do we get up there?
There's a ladder in the hallway, somewhere in the ceiling.
Wearily, Sanjeev followed at the back of the crowd to point out the location of the ladder, but Twinkle had already found it on her own.
Eureka! She hollered.
Douglas pulled the chain that released the steps. His face was flushed, and he was wearing Nora's feather hat on his head. One by one, the guests disappeared, men helping women as they placed their strappy high heels on the narrow slats of the ladder, the Indian women wrapping the free ends of their expensive saris into their waistbands. The men followed behind, all quickly disappearing, until Sanjeev alone remained at the top of the winding staircase. Footsteps thundered over his head. He had no desire to join them. He wondered if the ceiling would collapse, imagined, for a split second, the sight of all the tumbling, drunk, perfumed bodies crashing, tangled around him. He heard a shriek, and then rising, spreading waves of laughter in discordant tones. Something fell, something else shattered. He could hear them babbling about a trunk. They seemed to be struggling to get it open, banging feverishly on its surface. He thought perhaps Twinkle would call for his assistance, but he was not summoned. He looked about the hallway and to the landing below, at the champagne glasses and half-eaten samosas and napkins smeared with lipstick, abandoned in every corner, on every available surface. Then he noticed that Twinkle, in her haste, had discarded her shoes altogether, for they lay by the foot of the ladder, black, patent leather mules with heels like golf tees, open toes, and slightly soiled silk labels on the instep where her soles had rested. He placed them in the doorway of the master bedroom so that no one would trip when they descended. He heard something creaking open slowly. The strident voices had subsided to an even murmur. It occurred to Sanjeev that he had the house all to himself. The music had ended, and he could hear, if he concentrated, the hum of the refrigerator and the rustle of the last leaves on the trees outside, and the tapping of their branches against the window panes. With one flick of his hand, he could snap the ladder back on its spring into the ceiling, and they would have no way of getting down unless he were to pull the chain and let them. He thought of all the things he could do undisturbed. He could sweep Twinkle's menagerie into a garbage bag and get in the car and drive it all to the dump, and tear down the poster of Weeping Jesus, and take a hammer to the Virgin Mary while he was at it. Then he would return to the empty house. He could easily clear up the cups and plates in an hour's time, and pour himself a gin and tonic and eat a plate of warm rice, and listen to his new Bach CD while reading the liner notes so as to understand it properly. He nudged the ladder slightly, but it was sturdily planted against the floor. Budging it would require some effort.
"My God, I need a cigarette!" Twinkle exclaimed from above.
Sanjeev felt knots forming at the back of his neck. He felt dizzy. He needed to lie down. He walked toward the bedroom, but stopped short when he saw Twinkle's shoes facing him in the doorway. He thought of her slipping them on her feet. But instead of feeling irritated, as he had ever since they'd moved into the house together, he felt a pang of anticipation at the thought of her rushing unsteadily down the winding staircase in them, scratching the floor a bit in her path. The pang intensified as he thought of her rushing to the bathroom to brighten her lipstick and eventually rushing to get people their coats and finally rushing to the cherrywood table when the last guest had left to begin opening their housewarming presents. It was the same pang he used to feel before they were married, when he would hang up the phone after one of their conversations, or when he would drive back from the airport wondering which ascending plane in the sky was hers.
"Sanj, you won't believe this!"
She emerged with her back to him, her hands over her head, the tops of her bare shoulder blades perspiring, supporting something still hidden from view.
"You got it, Twinkle?" someone asked.
"Yes, you can let go."
Now he saw that her hands were wrapped around it, a solid silver bust of Christ, the head easily 3 times the size of his own. It had a patrician bump on its nose, magnificent curly hair that rested atop a pronounced collarbone, and a broad forehead that reflected in miniature the walls and doors and lampshades around them. Its expression was confident, as if assured of its devotees, the unyielding lips sensuous and full. It was also sporting Nora's feather hat. As Twinkle descended, Sanjeev put his hands around her waist to balance her, and he relieved her of the bust when she reached the ground. It weighed a good 30 pounds. The others began lowering themselves slowly, exhausted from the hunt. Some trickled downstairs in search of a fresh drink. She took a breath, raised her eyebrows, crossed her fingers.
"Would you mind terribly if we displayed it on the mantel, just for tonight? I know you hate it."
He did hate it. He hated its immensity, and its flawless, polished surface, and its undeniable value. He hated that it was in his house and that he owned it. Unlike the other things they'd found, this contained dignity, solemnity, beauty even. But to his surprise, these qualities made him hate it all the more. Most of all, he hated it because he knew that Twinkle loved it.
"I'll keep it in my study from tomorrow," Twinkle added. "I promise."
She would never put it in her study, he knew. For the rest of their days together, she would keep it on the center of the mantel, flanked on either side by the rest of the menagerie. Each time they had guests, Twinkle would explain how she had found it, and they would admire her as they listened. He gazed at the crushed rose petals in her hair, at the pearl and sapphire choker at her throat, at the sparkly crimson polish on her toes. He decided these were among the things that made Prabal think she was wow. His head ached from gin, and his arms ached from the weight of the statue. He said, "I put your shoes in the bedroom."
"Thanks, but my feet are killing me."
Twinkle gave his elbow a little squeeze and headed for the living room. Sanjeev pressed the massive silver face to his ribs, careful not to let the feather hat slip, and followed her. The Treatment of Bibi Haldar. For the greater number of her 29 years, Bibi Haldar suffered from an ailment that baffled family, friends, priests, palmists, spinsters, gem therapists, prophets, and fools. In efforts to cure her, concerned members of our town brought her holy water from 7 holy rivers. When we heard her screams and throes in the night, when her wrists were bound with ropes and stinging poultices pressed upon her, we named her in our prayers. Wiseman had massaged eucalyptus balm into her temples, steamed her face with herbal infusions. At the suggestion of a blind Christian, she was once taken by train to kiss the tombs of saints and martyrs. Amulets warding against the evil eye girded her arms and neck. Auspicious stones adorned her fingers. Treatments offered by doctors only made matters worse. Allopaths, homeopaths, Ayurvedics, over time, all branches of the medical arts had been consulted. Their advice was endless. After x-rays, probes, auscultations, and injections, some merely advised Bibi to gain weight, others to lose it. If one forbade her to sleep beyond dawn, another insisted she remain in bed till noon. This one told her to perform headstands, that one to chant Vedic verses at specified intervals throughout the day. "Take her to Calcutta for hypnosis," was a suggestion still others would offer. Shuttled from one specialist to the next, the girl had been prescribed to shun garlic, consume disproportionate quantities of bitters, meditate, drink green coconut water, and swallow raw duck's eggs beaten in milk. In short, Bibi's life was an encounter with one fruitless antidote after another. The nature of her illness, which struck without warning, confined her world to the unpainted 4-story building in which her only local family, an elder cousin and his wife, rented an apartment on the 2nd floor. Liable to fall unconscious and enter at any moment into a shameless delirium, Bibi could be trusted neither to cross a street nor board a tram without supervision. Her daily occupation consisted of sitting in the storage room on the roof of our building, a space in which one could sit but not comfortably stand, featuring an adjoining latrine, a curtained entrance, one window without a grill, and shelves made from the panels of old doors. There, cross-legged on a square of jute, she recorded inventory for the cosmetics shop that her cousin Haldar owned and managed at the mouth of our courtyard. For her services, Bibi received no income, but was given meals, provisions, and sufficient meters of cotton at every October holiday to replenish her wardrobe at an inexpensive tailor. At night, she slept on a folding camp cot in the cousin's place downstairs. In the mornings, Bibi arrived in the storage room, wearing cracked plastic slippers and a house coat whose hem stopped some inches below the knee, a length we had not worn since we were 15. Her shins were hairless and sprayed with a generous number of pallid freckles. She bemoaned her fate and challenged her stars as we hung our laundry or scrubbed scales from our fish. She was not pretty. Her upper lip was thin, her teeth too small. Her gums protruded when she spoke.
"I ask you, is it fair for a girl to sit out her years, past neglected through her prime, listing labels and prices without promise of a future?"
Her voice was louder than necessary, as if she were speaking to a deaf person.
"Is it wrong to envy you, all brides and mothers, busy with lives and cares? Wrong to want to shade my eyes, scent my hair, to raise a child and teach him sweet from sour, good from bad?"
Each day, she unloaded her countless privations upon us until it became unendurably apparent that Bibi wanted a man. She wanted to be spoken for, protected, placed on her path in life. Like the rest of us, she wanted to serve suppers and scold servants and set aside money in her almari to have her eyebrows threaded every 3 weeks at the Chinese beauty parlor. She pestered us for details of our own weddings, the jewels, the invitations, the scent of tuberoses strung over the nuptial bed. When, at her insistence, we showed her our photo albums embossed with the designs of butterflies, she pored over the snapshots that chronicled the ceremony. Butter poured in fires, garlands exchanged, vermilion painted fish, trays of shells and silver coins. An impressive number of guests, she would observe, stroking with her finger the misplaced faces that had surrounded us.
When it happens to me, you will all be present.
Anticipation began to plague her with such ferocity that the thought of a husband on which all her hopes were pinned threatened at times to send her into another attack. Amid tins of talc and boxes of bobby pins, she would curl up on the floor of the storage room, speaking in non sequiturs.
I will never dip my feet in milk, she whimpered. My face will never be painted with sandalwood paste. Who will rub me with turmeric? My name will never be printed with scarlet ink on a card.
Her soliloquies mawkish, her sentiments maudlin, malaise dripped like a fever from her pores. In the most embittered moments, we wrapped her in shawls, washed her face from the cistern tap, and brought her glasses of yogurt and rose water. In moments when she was less disconsolate, we encouraged her to accompany us to the tailor and replenish her blouses and petticoats, in part to provide her with a change of scenery, and in part because we thought it might increase whatever matrimonial prospects she had. No man wants a woman who dresses like a dishwasher, we told her.
Do you want all that fabric of yours to go to the moths?
She sulked, pouted, protested, and sighed.
Where do I go? Who would I dress for? She demanded. Who takes me to the cinema, the zoo garden, buys me lime soda and cashews? Admit it! Are these concerns of mine? I will never be cured, never married.
But then a new treatment was prescribed for Bibi, the most outrageous of them all. One evening on her way to dinner, she collapsed on the third floor landing, pounding her fists, kicking her feet, sweating buckets, lost to this world. Her moans echoed through the stairwell, and we rushed out of our apartments to calm her at once, bearing palm fans and sugar cubes and tumblers of refrigerated water to pour on her head. Our children clung to the banisters and witnessed her paroxysm. Our servants were sent to summon her cousin. It was 10 minutes before Haldar emerged from his shop, impassive apart from the red in his face. He told us to stop fussing, and then, with no efforts to repress his disdain, he packed her into a rickshaw bound for the polyclinic. It was there, after performing a series of blood tests, that the doctor in charge of Bibi's case, exasperated, concluded that a marriage would cure her. News spread between our window bars, across our clotheslines, and over the pigeon droppings that plastered the parapets of our rooftops. By the next morning, 3 separate palmists had examined Bibi's hand and confirmed that there was no doubt evidence of an imminent union etched into her skin. Unsavory sorts murmured indelicacies at cutlet stands. Grandmothers consulted almanacs to determine a propitious hour for the betrothal. For days afterward, as we walked our children to school, picked up our cleaning, stood in lines at the ration shop, we whispered. Apparently, some activity was what the poor girl needed all along. For the first time, we imagined the contours below her housecoat and attempted to appraise the pleasures she could offer a man. For the first time, we noted the clarity of her complexion, the length and languor of her eyelashes, the undeniably elegant armature of her hands. They say it's the only hope, a case of overexcitement. They say, and here we paused, blushing, relations will calm her blood. Needless to say, Bibi was delighted by the diagnosis and began at once to prepare for conjugal life. With some damaged merchandise from Haldar's shop, she polished her toenails and softened her elbows. Neglecting the new shipments delivered to the storage room, she began hounding us for recipes, for vermicelli pudding and papaya stew, and inscribed them in crooked letters in the pages of her inventory ledger. She made guest lists, dessert lists, listed lands in which she intended to honeymoon. She applied glycerin to smooth her lips, resisted sweets to reduce her measurements. One day, she asked one of us to accompany her to the tailor, who stitched her a new salwar kameez in an umbrella cut, the fashion that season. On the streets, she dragged us to the counters of each and every jeweler, peering into glass cases, seeking our opinions of tiara designs and locket settings. In the windows of sari shops, she pointed to a magenta Benassari silk and a turquoise one, and then one the color of marigolds.
The first part of the ceremony I will wear this one, then this one, then this.
But Haldar and his wife thought otherwise. Immune to her fancies, indifferent to our fears, they conducted business as usual, stuffed together in that cosmetic shop no bigger than a wardrobe, whose walls were crammed on three sides with hennas, hair oils, pumice stones, and fairness creams.
"We have little time for indecent suggestions," replied Haldar to those who broached the subject of Bibi's health. "What won't be cured must be endured. Bibi has caused enough worry, added enough to expenses, sullied enough the family name."
His wife, seated beside him, behind the tiny glass counter, fanned the mottled skin above her breasts and agreed. She was a heavy woman whose powder, a shade too pale for her, caked in the creases of her throat.
"Besides, who would marry her? The girl knows nothing about anything, speaks backward, is practically 30, can't light a stove, can't boil rice, can't tell the difference between fennel and a cumin seed. Imagine her attempting to feed a man."
They had a point. Bibi had never been taught to be a woman. The illness had left her naive in most practical matters. Haldar's wife, convinced that the devil himself possessed her, kept Bibi away from fire and flame. She had not been taught to wear a sari without pinning it in four different places, nor could she embroider slipcovers or crochet shawls with any exceptional talent. She was not allowed to watch the television. Haldar assumed its electronic properties would excite her, and was thus ignorant of the events and entertainments of our world. Her formal studies had ended after the 9th standard. For Bibi's sake, we argued in favor of finding a husband.
"It's what she's wanted all along," we pointed out.
But Haldar and his wife were impossible to reason with. Their rancor toward Bibi was fixed on their lips, thinner than the strings with which they tied our purchases. When we maintained that the new treatment deserved a chance, they contended,
"Bibi possesses insufficient quantities of respect and self-control. She plays up her malady for the attention. The best thing is to keep her occupied, away from the trouble she invariably creates."
"Why not marry her off, then? It will get her off your hands, at least."
"And waste our profits on a wedding? Feeding guests, ordering bracelets, buying a bed, assembling a dowry?"
But Bibi's gripes persisted. Late one morning, dressed under our supervision in a sari of lavender eyelet chiffon and mirrored slippers lent to her for the occasion, she hastened in uneven steps to Haldar's shop and insisted on being taken to the photographer's studio so that her portrait, like those of other brides-in-waiting, could be circulated in the homes of eligible men. Through the shutters of our balconies, we watched her. Perspiration had already left little black moons beneath her armpits.
"Apart from my x-rays, I have never been photographed," she fretted. "Potential in-laws need to know what I look like."
But Haldar refused. He said that anyone who wished to see her could observe her for themselves, weeping and wailing and warding off customers. She was a bane for business, he told her, a liability and a loss. Who in this town needed a photo to know that? The next day, Bibi stopped listing inventory altogether and regaled us instead with imprudent details about Haldar and his wife.
"On Sundays, he plucks hairs from her chin. They keep their money refrigerated under lock and key."
For the benefit of neighboring rooftops, she strutted and shrieked. With each proclamation, her audience expanded.
"In the bath, she applies chickpea flour to her arms because she thinks it will make her paler. The third toe on her right foot is missing. The reason they take such long siestas is that she is impossible to please."
To get her to quiet down, Haldar placed a one-line advertisement in the town newspaper in order to solicit a groom.
"Girl, unstable, height 152 centimeters, seeks husband."
The identity of the prospective bride was no secret to the parents of our young men, and no family was willing to shoulder so blatant a risk. Who could blame them? It was rumored by many that Bibi conversed with herself in a fluent but totally incomprehensible language, and slept without dreams. Even the lonely four-toothed widower who repaired our handbags in the market could not be persuaded to propose. Nevertheless, to distract her, we began to coach her in wifely ways.
"Frowning like a rice pot will get you nowhere. Men require that you caress them with your expression."
As practice for the event of encountering a possible suitor, we urged her to engage in small conversations with nearby men. When the water-bearer arrived at the end of his rounds to fill Bibi's urn in the storage room, we instructed her to say, "How do you do?" When the coal supplier unloaded his baskets on the roof, we advised her to smile and make a comment about the weather. Recalling our own experiences, we prepared her for an interview. "Most likely the groom will arrive with one parent, a grandparent, or either an uncle or aunt. They will stare, ask several questions. They will examine the bottoms of your feet, the thickness of your braid. They will ask you to name the prime minister, recite poetry, feed a dozen hungry people on half a dozen eggs." When 2 months had passed without a single reply to the advertisement, Haldar and his wife felt vindicated.
"Now do you see that she is unfit to marry? Now do you see no man of sane mind would touch her?"
Things had not been so bad for Bibi before her father died. The mother had not survived beyond the birth of the girl. In his final years, the old man, a teacher of mathematics in our elementary schools, had kept assiduous track of Bibi's illness in hopes of determining some logic to her condition. "To every problem there is a solution," he would reply whenever we inquired after his progress. He reassured Bibi. For a time, he reassured us all. He wrote letters to doctors in England, spent his evenings reading casebooks at the library, gave up eating meat on Fridays in order to appease his household god. Eventually, he gave up teaching as well, tutoring only from his room, so that he could monitor Bibi at all hours. But though in his youth he had received prizes for his ability to deduce square roots from memory, he was unable to solve the mystery of his daughter's disease. For all his work, his records led him to conclude only that Bibi's attacks occurred more frequently in summer than winter, and that she had suffered approximately 25 major attacks in all. He created a chart of her symptoms with directions for calming her and distributed it throughout the neighborhood. But these were eventually lost or turned into sailboats by our children, or used to calculate grocery budgets on the reverse side. Apart from keeping her company, apart from soothing her woes, apart from keeping an occasional eye on her, there was little we could do to improve the situation. None of us were capable of understanding such desolation. Some days, after siesta, we combed out her hair, remembering now and then to change the part in her scalp so that it would not grow too broad. At her request, we powdered the down over her lips and throat, penciled definition into her brows, and walked her to the banks of the fish pond, where our children played cricket in the afternoon. She was still determined to lure a man.
"Apart from my condition, I am perfectly healthy," she maintained, seating herself on a bench along a footpath where courting men and women strolled hand in hand. "I have never had a cold or flu. I have never had jaundice. I have never suffered from colic or indigestion."
Sometimes we brought her smoked corn on the cob sprinkled with lemon juice, or 2 paisa caramels. We consoled her. When she was convinced a man was giving her the eye, we humored her and agreed. But she was not our responsibility, and in our private moments, we were thankful for it. In November, we learned that Haldar's wife was pregnant. That morning in the storage room, Bibi wept.
"She says I'm contagious like the pox. She says I'll spoil the baby."
She was breathing heavily, her pupils fixed to a peeling spot on the wall.
"What will become of me?"
There was still no response to the advertisement in the newspaper.
"Is it not punishment enough that I must bear this curse alone? Must I also be blamed for infecting another?"
Dissent within the Haldar household grew. The wife, convinced that Bibi's presence would infect the unborn child, began to wrap woolen shawls around her tumid belly. In the bathroom, Bibi was given separate soaps and towels. According to the scullery maid, Bibi's plates were not washed with the others. And then, one afternoon, without word or warning, it happened again. On the banks of the fish pond, Bibi fell to the footpath. She shook, she shuddered, she chewed her lips. A group encircled the convulsing girl at once, eager to assist in whatever way possible. The opener of soda bottles pinned down her thrashing limbs. The vendor of sliced cucumbers attempted to unclasp her fingers. One of us doused her with water from the pond. Another wiped her mouth with a perfumed handkerchief. The seller of jackfruits was holding Bibi's head, which struggled to toss from side to side. And the man who cranked the sugarcane press gripped the palm fan that he ordinarily used to chase away flies, agitating the air from every conceivable angle.
Is there a doctor in the crowd? Watch that she doesn't swallow her tongue.
Has anyone informed Halda?
She's hotter than coals.
In spite of our efforts, the tumult persisted. Wrestling with her adversary, racked with anguish, she ground her teeth and twitched at the knees. Over 2 minutes had passed. We watched and worried. We wondered what to do.
Leather! Someone cried suddenly. She needs to smell leather!
Then we remembered the last time it had happened, a cowhide sandal held under her nostrils was what finally freed Bibi from the clutches of her torment.
Bibi, what happened? Tell us what happened,
we asked when she opened her eyes.
I felt hot, then hotter. Smoke passed before my eyes. The world went black. Didn't you see it?
A group of our husbands escorted her home. Dusk thickened, conch shells were blown, and the air grew dense with the incense of prayers. Bibi muttered and staggered, but said nothing. Her cheeks were bruised and nicked here and there. Her hair was matted, her elbows caked with dirt, and a small piece of one front tooth was missing. We followed behind, at what we assumed to be safe distances, holding our children by the hand. She needed a blanket, a compress, a sedative tablet. She needed supervision. But when we reached the courtyard, Haldar and his wife would not have her in the flat.
The medical risk is too great for an expectant mother to be in contact with an hysterical person, he insisted.
That night, Bibi slept in the storage room. Their baby, a girl, was delivered by forceps at the end of June. By then, Bibi was sleeping downstairs again, though they kept her camp cot in the corridor and would not let her touch the child directly. Every day they sent her to the roof to record inventory until lunch, at which point Haldar brought her receipts from the morning sales and a bowl of yellow split peas for her lunch. At night she ate milk and bread alone in the stairwell. Another seizure, and another, went unchecked. When we voiced our concern, Haldar said it was not our business and flatly refused to discuss the matter. To express our indignation, we began to take our shopping elsewhere. This provided us with our only revenge. Over the weeks, the products on Haldar's shelves grew dusty. Labels faded and colognes turned rank. Passing by in the evenings, we saw Haldar sitting alone, swatting moths with the sole of his slipper. We hardly saw the wife at all. According to the scullery maid, she was still bedridden. Apparently, her labor had been complicated. Autumn came, with its promise of the October holidays, and the town grew busy shopping and planning for the season. Film songs blared from amplifiers strung through trees. Arcades and markets stayed open all hours. We bought our children balloons and colored ribbons, purchased sweetmeats by the kilo, paid calls in taxis to relatives we had not seen throughout the year. The days grew shorter, the evenings colder. We buttoned our sweaters and pulled up our socks. Then a chill set in that made our throats itch. We made our children gargle with warm salt water and wrap mufflers around their necks. But it was the Haldar baby who ended up getting sick. A doctor was summoned in the middle of the night and commanded to reduce the fever.
Cure her,
the wife pleaded. Her shrill commotion had woken us all.
We can give you anything, just cure my baby girl.
The doctor prescribed a glucose formula, crushed aspirins in a mortar, and told them to wrap the child with quilts and covers. 5 days later, the fever had not budged.
It's Bibi, the wife wailed. She's done it. She's infected our child. We should never have let her come back down here. We should never have let her back into this house.
And so, Bibi started to spend her nights in the storage room again. At the wife's insistence, Haldar even moved her camp cot up there, along with a tin trunk that contained her belongings. Her meals were left covered with a colander at the top of the stairs.
I don't mind, Bibi told us. It's better to live apart from them, to set up house on my own.
she unpacked the trunk, some house coats, a framed portrait of her father, sewing supplies, and an assortment of fabrics, and arranged her things on a few empty shelves. By the week's end, the baby had recuperated, but Bibi was not asked to return downstairs.
"Don't worry, it's not as if they've locked me in here," she said in order to set us at ease. "The world begins at the bottom of the stairs. Now I am free to discover life as I please."
But in truth, she stopped going out altogether. When we asked her to come with us to the fish pond or to go see temple decorations, she refused, claiming that she was stitching a new curtain to hang across the entrance of the storage room. Her skin looked ashen. She needed fresh air. "What about finding you a husband?" we suggested. "How do you expect to charm a man sitting up there all day?" Nothing persuaded her. By mid-December, Haldar cleared all the unsold merchandise off the shelves of his beauty shop and hauled them in boxes up to the storage room. We had succeeded in driving him more or less out of business. Before the year's end, the family moved away, leaving an envelope containing 300 rupees under Bibi's door. There was no more news of them. One of us had an address for a relation of Bibi's in Hyderabad, and wrote, explaining the situation. The letter was returned unopened, address unknown. Before the coldest weeks set in, we had the shutters of the storage room repaired and attached a sheet of tin to the doorframe so that she would at least have some privacy. Someone donated a kerosene lamp. Another gave her some old mosquito netting and a pair of socks without heels. At every opportunity, we reminded her that we surrounded her, that she could come to us if she ever needed advice or aid of any kind. For a time, we sent our children to play on the roof in the afternoons so that they could alert us if she was having another attack. But each night, we left her alone. Some months passed. Bibi had retreated into a deep and prolonged silence. We took turns leaving her plates of rice and glasses of tea. She drank little, ate less, and began to assume an expression that no longer matched her years. At twilight, she circled the parapet once or twice, but she never left the rooftop. After dark, she remained behind the tin door and did not come out for any reason. We did not disturb her. Some of us began to wonder if she was dying. Others concluded that she had lost her mind. One morning in April, when the heat had returned for drying lentil wafers on the roof, we noticed that someone had vomited by the cistern tap. When we noticed this a second morning as well, we knocked on Bibi's tin door. When there was no answer, we opened it ourselves, as there was no lock to fasten it. We found her lying on the camp cot. She was about 4 months pregnant. She said she could not remember what had happened. She would not tell us who had done it. We prepared her semolina with hot milk and raisins. Still, she would not reveal the man's identity. In vain we searched for traces of the assault, some sign of the intrusion, but the room was swept and in order. On the floor beside the cot, her inventory ledger, open to a fresh page, contained a list of names. She carried the baby to full term, and one evening in September, we helped her deliver a son. We showed her how to feed him and bathe him and lull him to sleep. We bought her an oilcloth and helped her stitch clothes and pillowcases out of the fabric she had saved over the years. Within a month, Bibi had recuperated from the birth, and with the money that Haldar had left her, she had the storage room whitewashed and placed padlocks on the window and doors. Then she dusted the shelves and arranged the leftover potions and lotions, selling Haldar's old inventory at half price. She told us to spread word of the sale, and we did. From Bibi, we purchased our soaps and coal, our combs and powders, and when she had sold the last of her merchandise, she went by taxi to the wholesale market, using her profits to restock the shelves. In this manner, she raised the boy and ran a business in the storage room, and we did what we could to help. For years afterward, we wondered who in our town had disgraced her. A few of our servants were questioned, and in tea stalls and bus stands, possible suspects were debated and dismissed. But there was no point carrying out an investigation. She was, to the best of our knowledge, cured. The Third and Final Continent. I left India in 1964 with a certificate of commerce and the equivalent in those days of $10 to my name. For 3 weeks I sailed on the SS Roma, an Italian cargo vessel, in a cabin next to the ship's engine, across the Arabian Sea, the Red Sea, the Mediterranean, and finally to England. I lived in North London, in Finsbury Park, in a house occupied entirely by penniless Bengali bachelors like myself, at least a dozen and sometimes more, all struggling to educate and establish ourselves abroad. I attended lectures at LSE and worked at the university library to get by. We lived three or four to a room, shared a single icy toilet, and took turns cooking pots of egg curry, which we ate with our hands on a table covered with newspapers. Apart from our jobs, we had few responsibilities. On weekends, we lounged barefoot in drawstring pajamas, drinking tea and smoking Rothmans, or set out to watch cricket at Lord's. Some weekends, the house was crammed with still more Bengalis, to whom we had introduced ourselves at the greengrocer or on the tube, and we made yet more egg curry and played Mukesh on a Grundig reel-to-reel and soaked our dirty dishes in the bathtub. Every now and then, someone in the house moved out to live with a woman whom his family back in Calcutta had determined he was to wed. In 1969, when I was 36 years old, my own marriage was arranged. Around the same time, I was offered a full-time job in America, in the processing department of a library at MIT. The salary was generous enough to support a wife, and I was honored to be hired by a world-famous university, and so I obtained a sixth preference green card and prepared to travel farther still. By now, I had enough money to go by plane. I flew first to Calcutta to attend my wedding, and a week later I flew to Boston to begin my new job. During the flight, I read The Student Guide to North America, a paperback volume that I'd bought before leaving London, for 7 shillings 6 pence on Tottenham Court Road, for although I was no longer a student, I was on a budget all the same.